Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our third instalment of God of Beer in the West. My name is Jared. I'll be your host this evening. God of Beer is an initiative of the Knights of the Southern Cross. It's aimed to bring people together of all ages across the suburbs of Melbourne. Our aim is to inspire and strengthen Christians by providing ideas and inspiration for renewing the church by drawing on the truth and goodness of the Catholic tradition. We'll start off with a prayer. If we could all ask for our Blessed Mother's intercession. And the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Hail Mary,
full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death.
Amen. Just before we start, I'd like to thank our sponsor, the Catholic Development Fund. So the CDF is here to put faith into action. They do this through the delivery of financial solutions that balance margin and mission for the common good. The CDF supports the mission of the Church by helping to build Christ-centred, redemptive and transformative communities. And it does this by pooling the savings of Catholic community to fund the constructions of schools, parishes, hospitals, aged care and social facilities. So thank you to the CDF. And just a couple of notices too. We've got the Knights, we've got the Archbishop's dinner coming up on the 29th of August, and that's at Moonee Valley. So tickets are still available to purchase up until the 15th of August. So that event raises money for the Priest Support and Development Fund for new seminarians. We've also got another event on another God, similar to God and Beer. It's Dr. Edward Shree, and the topic is Making Missionary Disciples. And there's one locally at Caroline Springs, and that is on the 31st of August. And there's also another one in Blackburn North, I believe on the same day, later in the afternoon, and then at Dandenong North the next day on the Sunday, on the 1st of September. Just before I introduce our speakers, a reminder we've got free tea and coffee up the back for you all. Drinks and food can still be purchased out front, and you're welcome to just bring it in anytime from the bistro. Restrooms are at the back, or at the front as you come in. And at the end of the talk, there'll be an opportunity to ask questions from our speakers. So if you think of something through the talk, write it down or jot it in your phone so you don't forget. And lastly, if you could please put your phones on silent just so we minimise interruptions during the talk. So our guest speakers this evening, introducing Father Jude Perotta, MSSP, and Sean Manette. And they'll be discussing building resilience and finding purpose through faith. Just as an introduction, Father Jude grew up in rural Victoria, and he was the eighth of 11 children. And at just 18, he answered the call to service. He joined the Paulist Missionaries. He completed his priestly formation at Catholic Theological College in Clayton and was ordained in 1984. Over the years, Father Jude has served in parishes across Victoria and New South Wales, including being assistant priest at St. Bernadette's in North Sunshine, and St. Michael's in Traralgon, where he was heavily involved in youth ministry. He also served as an administrator of the Paulist Retreat Centre in Monturna, and later as parish priest at Our Lady of Victories in Horsley Park in New South Wales. His ministerial journey has taken him far and wide, from clinical pastoral education at the Austin Hospital to supervisory training at INSTEP, and even to England, where he served at St. Anselm's Formation Institute in Margate. He's also ministered at the Melbourne Remand Centre. Since 2005, Father Jude has been a guiding presence at St. James the Apostle Parish in Hobbs Crossing North. He's a man of deep faith, rich experience, and unwavering commitment to community. Our second guest speaker is no stranger to Father Jude. Sean Manette is his nephew. a compassionate and experienced counsellor. Sean brings over 20 years of working in high-pressure environments to his practice and draws upon a combination of person-centred acceptance and commitment and solution-focused therapies. Whether he's supporting individuals, couples or groups, Sean creates a safe, non-judgmental space where people feel genuinely heard and empowered to navigate life's challenges. His background is as diverse as it is inspiring, from mentoring youth in schools and supporting expeditions in Antarctica to training air traffic controllers and facilitating men's groups here in Melbourne. Sean blends practical tools with a compassionate approach, helping people build resilience, self-awareness and meaningful change one step at a time. So please join me in welcoming Father Jude, Barotta and Sean Lennon.
It's an honour to be here with you all tonight. The invitation of the Knights of the Southern Cross alongside with my nephew Sean. Some people made comments about the look-alike, so if you want to know what I looked like years ago, our topic...
It's a bit scary.
It's a bit scary.
You know where I'm going with this.
Yeah, exactly. Although he's got better genes with the hair than I, my side. Look, our topic tonight is building resilience in and finding purpose through faith. It's a very wide topic for some of our young ones. I hope this can serve as a tool for you once you had a lived experience, okay? Because it may not be something you can engage with at the moment. I'm going to attempt to share my own personal experience and how faith has contributed and empowered me to rise again, particularly after facing burnout in 1991. I have no shame about that. I'm always connecting with Jesus, coming out of the tomb and rising from the dead and carrying his wounds with him. There was no shame, if you remember the story. I will explore how spiritual faith can be the foundation of building a resilience to the challenges and setbacks that we all face as we navigate the world and the various tools we need to do so. It's important to remember that this experience happened to me 7 years after I was ordained. So many years have passed. One advantage of that is I've now got the tools to sense what the signs are and to do something about it. So, this is going to be my sacred story, and as I share my perspective and experience, I hope that this story will be a blessing and an encouragement to you as well. Just going to invite Sean now to just share a little bit about himself. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Jude. And thanks, Jared, for the introduction. It's really a privilege to be standing here with, I can't call him Father Jude. Sorry about that. He's Uncle Jude to me. So, yeah, I can't, the Father Jude thing, it's just not a habit.
Doesn't work.
But from being the first of our family to be baptised by him and back in 1984... 1983, I think it would have been at that point, to the help that he's provided me in navigating my own kind of personal challenges more recently. He's just played such an important role in my life, as he has, I'm sure, in most of, if not all, of the lives in this room right now. when he reached out to see if I'd be interested in contributing to tonight, you know, there's only one answer to that question. And as we discussed what the theme of the evening was, it became quite clear how our paths intertwine as they would. As a counsellor working predominantly with men and in the relationship space, it's my lived experience as much as it is my professional experience that has allowed me to connect and empathise and support those people with whatever it is they're going through. So tonight's presentation isn't just theoretical for us, it's well and truly a practical exercise. We've both been through our own versions, as have no doubt everyone in this room has been through some version of adversity. And it's what we've been able to take away from it and the reflections that have come out of that that we'll speak more about this evening. So regardless of where anyone here is in their own journey, whether you're currently fighting your own battles or preparing for the next one, we hope there's a bit of inspiration. We hope there might be some practical tools available in what we've got to say as well. So we do have time for questions later on. We really encourage people to reach out if there's something that strikes them as interesting or they'd like to know more about, so please feel free to engage. So having all said all that, where should we begin? I'll give you this up. Uncle Jude, can you kick us off? Can you tell us a time where you felt lost?
Okay, that's a good place to start. Way back in 1984, I was assigned to the parish of St. Bernadette's in Lost Sunshine. Sean's correct, I did baptise him. I was a deacon at that stage in 83. I was the longest reigning deacon in the Archdiocese of Melbourne. Father Jerry Dowling, some may know him. Still remember Jerry, who used to have a radio counselling program. He used to call me his permanent deacon here in Melbourne. St. Bernadette's was a vibrant parish. I'm high on the extroversion level, or I was even higher back then. Okay? God has his own way of bringing us to a balanced way of life. And 27 years of age, bursting with energy, I would spend up to 15 hours a day ministering to anyone who called. Ridiculous, isn't it? 15 hours a day. And finding it difficult to say no, leaving very little time for myself. Didn't take long before I started to feel fatigued, losing interest in the ministry. Whenever the doorbell or phone would ring, I'd do my best to avoid answering. I started losing touch of my identity, found myself inadvertently becoming a people pleaser, lost sight of what matters most, and began to spend very little time with God. However, I persevered without sharing my feelings with anyone. I saw that as perhaps a weakness, especially as a male. You had to, as a priest, be in control. That's my perception, right? Priests don't cry. You've got to help people snap out of it. All of that unrealistic stuff. It's just not human. But they're the messages that I picked up in the journey of life. Remember Father Cagney coming in? If people were crying, he would stop the crying straight away. And I thought, oh, that's good. That means we're not hurting anymore. You know, these are messages that we pick up along the way. I just threw that one in, Sean. Because Sean and I have been looking at the personal experiences and what probably would benefit all of us. It was in 1987 that one of the altar servers, a haemophiliac, had been diagnosed with AIDS through a blood transfusion. Now, if you remember back to the time when AIDS was sounded off, it wasn't actually acknowledged till 1984. In 1983, this young haemophiliac had a blood transfusion and he received contaminated blood. The people in the neighbourhood were scared. Many people shifted houses. The family went through murder. It was a very difficult time, and I got very much involved in all of that. At the same time, my nephew was diagnosed with leukemia. That's Sean's cousin. So once again, I became overactive in my ministry. And this eventually caught up with me, and I found myself suffering with exhaustion. So that's pretty much a time when I really felt lost. Sean?
Yeah, and it's something that we often don't realise until it's too late. We just keep burning the candle at both ends and, until there's nothing left. And it's not a deliberate thing, it's not a malicious thing, it's not even a conscious thing. You know, we're just at the mercy of the circumstances that are driving our lives at that point. I work with clients regularly that are hovering just above, if not have hit rock bottom. And there's, you know, that looks different for everybody, but the symptoms are the same. It's like life cannot seemingly get any worse, and I don't know how I got here. And there's so much confusion that goes with that. There's identity crises, there's grief, there's a lot of big emotions because there's this hopelessness that goes with it. I thought I was doing the right thing. I thought I was on the right track. And now I don't know what to do. So it's that hopelessness that I feel resonates with a lot of us. We've all been through experiences that have had us in similar situations. For me, I'm fortunate enough to have been there a number of times. Most recent, 2019, it was a game of indoor soccer that changed my life. It was a couple of minutes to run, and I ruptured my Achilles out of nowhere. And in the aftermath of that, laid up on the couch with my leg in plaster for a couple of weeks, I had time for the first time in a really long time. And it wasn't great. It didn't feel particularly comfortable because I began to reflect on what got me to that point on the couch. I reflected on the relationship that I'd been in, the marriage that wasn't working, the decisions that I'd made to get to that point, and it all started to unravel. The Achilles rupture led to a 12-month physical rehab process to get back on my feet, to get back into doing the things that I love. But in the aftermath of that, my marriage collapsed, which led to its own struggles. Financial uncertainty, having to organise a new living situation. Some of you might remember I was living at St James for a couple of months back in 2019. Between St James, between work, living out of my car, the gym, nothing was stable, nothing was certain. And thankfully, with the support that I had access to, I was able to start rebuilding. But it takes time. My career was changing at the same time as well. I'd been operating in a teaching role as an air traffic controller. I'd been training air traffic controllers across the country, and it was time for me to go back to being the trainee. So something that I'd gone from being proficient at no longer existed. Everything had been called into question. And at that point, you start asking yourself, where do I even start here? And it's not until further down the line that we realise that the resilience isn't something that happens consciously. It's something that's a byproduct of survival. So, Uncle Jude, let me ask you, where have you found resilience?
Yeah, good question, Sean. It was at that moment when I let my guards down, and I think at that stage I had to embrace my own vulnerability. I don't know whether John, you were the provincial at the time, but either you or whoever was the provincial gave me some advice of heading off overseas, go and have a holiday. And there was a family from the parish, and they joined me. It was a difficult decision, as I felt compelled to stay with my nephew Lincoln and also with Robbie, leaving almost felt like I was abandoning them. But I remember on my return home after 3 months, I thought I'd stop over in Pakistan and visit there because I served as a deacon there for 12 months. So the guys had always been saying, when is he coming back to visit? When is he coming back? So I made sure that I did a stopover in Pakistan. Soon after I arrived, I received word that the young boy, Robbie, had died at that stage. And I found myself, something extraordinary happened at that point, and I was really lashing out at God. I never did this before. I was always using formal prayer, but that personal communication, allowing myself to be angry with God, was something I wasn't used to, right? And I remember using St. Teresa of Avila's prayer, and I'll just quote her, "Since you treat your beloved like this, it's no wonder you have so few friends." And I remember making that my own. Then I opened up the scriptures, and one of my favourite verses that's become now is from Jeremiah. You know, "My plans for you are for peace and not disaster, holding for you a future full of hope. When you call to me, I will listen to you. When you seek me with all of your heart." Those words I often refer back to, especially when I feel like I'm sinking again. So it was here that I felt myself banging at heaven's doors, this deep sense of the presence of God in the midst of crises, identifying again with the words of St. Augustine, "Our hearts are restless, Lord, until they rest in you." I suddenly felt a great calmness, an intimacy and serene presence that I wished would last forever. And my fear no longer seemed to paralyze me. I was ready to go home now, and I knew that I was going to face another death. And I left Pakistan after 2 months to return home, and on that day, Lincoln had died. And so again, I resumed my ministry at St. Bernadette's, but something told me that I had to retrace the events of my life on the road less traveled and revisit those areas of my life that I had avoided for so long. It somehow meant for me that this has got to be something. I always was fascinated with people, and I always wanted to know what made me tick, let alone how people ticked as well. And my provincial invited me again to seek an appointment with Dan, a psychologist, a clinical psychologist, who was a friend of the society. Now, when I was growing up as a kid, anyone who said they were going to see a counsellor or a psychologist meant you had something wrong up here. Okay? So you avoided them like the plague. Sorry, Sean. I think that stigma has gone by now, I hope. Or is it still there? Is it?
A little bit.
It was here, however, being humble enough to be able to say, now I'm going to try a new freedom in finding purpose and meaning. The death of my father in 1972 had a huge impact on my life, and I didn't realise that that was journeying with me into my adult years. Are you with us so far, guys? Okay. It's very courageous, I know, for us, but we've worked through this, you know? So don't all think, oh, there's a lot of work still to be done in your life. No, this is an awareness. And when we're aware, we'll talk about that later. We no longer have to cast blame, okay? Dan, the psychologist, and he was able to direct me to see and value the value of slowing down, setting new goals for myself. I discovered that in Robbie and Lincoln's death, I gave permission to let go of my deceased father and to stop casting blame for his absence in my life. And when you're 14 and your dad dies, that's when you want to lean on a bloke, you know, your male model. So that pretty much is where I started finding resilience.
Yeah, and it's something, like we said before, it's something we don't realise at the time that we're building that resilience. It's only upon the opportunity to reflect that we realise how far we've come, how much we've grown, how much strength we actually have. This isn't a discussion around how do you become more resilient. You're already resilient. It's just as important to actually take some time to recognise the evidence you already have that supports that argument. For me, it was not until we all went into lockdown during COVID, because apparently God has a sense of humour, that I finally had a chance to stop. I'd been in survival mode for 2 years trying to work out like how to get life back on track. And so without any aeroplanes to play with, I was at home for the first time with nothing to do. And I picked up something that I'd put away 15 years prior, and that's the reflective power of journaling. I'm sure everyone's heard of the idea of writing down your thoughts, and it's like, I can't do that. I just started typing, and over the course of the 18 plus months that we were in that situation, I've got 250,000 words of my own thoughts. It just helped clarify why I am the way I am, why these patterns have shown up and keep showing up. And again, when I went to Antarctica, it was the silence there that gives your system a chance to just slow down and pay attention to what really matters and what gets you to where you are. There's so much value in that exercise. We learn so much in that silence, and in a world where we're constantly subjected to information and distraction and everything else that kind of comes with modern living these days, having to consciously schedule time to do nothing, which is something in itself, is such a powerful thing. We talk about prayer, we talk about mindfulness and meditation. Sitting in silence is just as powerful. Sitting with your own thoughts and the discomfort that comes up will tell you so much. It will highlight so much. So I came to the realization that without something driving me, without the belief that if I just keep going, I'll manage to get through the next hour, the next day, the next year, if I keep going, things will get better. Which is where faith comes into the equation. Resilience wasn't running the show, faith was driving it. And it's just that core belief that I just need to hold on for a bit longer. I just need to get through this bit and the next bit, and at some point things will improve. And it's a powerful lesson. I think all of us that have gone through phases of life that feel impossible in the moment, whether it's moving house, whether it's the birth of a new child, whether it's a relationship failing, a job loss, we all know. We all have our own body of evidence that proves that we can get through difficult times. So, Uncle Jude, how has faith helped you?
Yeah, it's a good question, Sean. I came to the awareness then that through these crisis moments in my life, that God was with me in the midst of my struggles, that He had a plan for me in my life. Going back to that beautiful verse from Jeremiah, I believe that in my mid-30s, I was hearing God say, here is a part of me that I've never seen before. Here is an invitation that's new. Here is a wound or a new possibility that God couldn't share with me before because I was in survival mode. When I've broken down, we'd have been 33. I remember my supervisor saying, you're in good stead. Wasn't JC around about that age when he was crucified? Because that's how it felt. My ego had blocked me from reaching out for help from others and from God. From God himself. And I'd close the door of my heart. My perception of my role within the priesthood, as I alluded to earlier, had led me to believe that I had to be in control all the time. Vulnerability wasn't an option, which limited my access to the support that I needed. I even remember apologizing because I was crying at a funeral. And the family said, "Don't be stupid, you gave us permission to grieve." You know, I didn't realize these were things that, you know, were so important to my priesthood. And I'm hiding them. And yet, it could have been so more effective just to live out of my humanity as Jesus had given to me. You know, I didn't know I had tear ducts for 20 years. You know, because when I was growing up, you know, I don't know if I'm jumping the gun, Sean, but when I was growing up, you know, at 14 years of old, I felt sad my dad died. People would smack me over the head and say, "Come on, snap out of it, little boys don't cry." Well, if little boys don't cry, then big boys surely mustn't cry. So I didn't operate these tear ducts. Later to find out from a doctor that God created us well. There's a chemical in the tear ducts that help the healing process. What was it?
Yeah, it's the tears of the body's morphine, right? Like the tears actually elicit a chemical reaction that helps us relieve pain. And crying completes the stress cycle. It's one of the ways that our body self-regulates in a way. And so people, yeah, when I see people in the professional context and they apologize for crying, I'm like, the fact that you're crying is a great thing. Like, will feel better after you cry. We've all felt better after a good cry. It's how it works. It's how it's designed to work.
Exactly, Sean. You can all go home and have good cries. And we're crying out loud. So through faith, I learned to lean on God, pray for strength and guidance, and ask him to help me through the difficult times. Through spending more time with scripture, on God's affirmation that I am loved and lovable. Wow, that's so important. And remembering that God is with me in the midst of my struggles. That's where I learned to cultivate supportive relationships, trust in relationships, surrounding myself with people who uplifted and encouraged me and where they were there for me and when I needed them most. So my faith did help me to practice self-care by getting enough sleep, eating a healthy diet, and engaging in regular exercise. I made time for activities that brought me joy and relaxation.
And there are a few common themes that kind of come up when we encounter these phases in our life. What gets us through those difficult times is our belief that at least at some level, whether we're conscious of it or not, we do believe that we can get through it. Whether that's just a blind perseverance, whether it's survival mode, there's a bunch of different quotes that come to mind. You know, "This too shall pass. The night is darkest before the dawn. You're not lost. You're exactly where you need to be." All of those kind of positive affirmation type things. They all rely on a level of faith that's driving it. So what begins as a fight for survival, which is often due to circumstances beyond our control, concludes with growth, with wisdom from the lessons that we've learned. We grow confident, we grow resilient in those moments. Without faith, none of that's available. Without faith, we'd roll up in a corner and allow the world to take over. We're hardwired to persevere and keep going. In the midst of the battles that we're fighting, it's faith that provides the beacon on the horizon that gives us something to aim at, something better than where we currently are. And at some point on the other side, when the war is over, we find that gratitude is available for the lessons that we learned along the way. In 2020, with 3 weeks left out of the lockdown period, I was weightlifting training in the car park with a friend of mine, and it was something that we'd been doing for months. We didn't tell the government, but we had a good setup. We were able to keep training, and kept us sane during the whole period. And I was attempting something fairly routine, and it didn't end up that way. I got crushed under 100 kilo barbell, rushed to the ED, and I knew I was in trouble when the doctor put the x-ray up on the light box, and the first words out of his mouth were, "I've never seen one of these before." That brought people from everywhere. Everyone wanted to see the x-ray. I dislocated my wrist in a way that the physio that ended up treated me, who had only ever seen one before, from a pilot who'd been involved in a light aircraft crash. I'd ruptured all of the ligaments, and they'd completely written off any chance of a full recovery. The surgeon described it as a catastrophic injury. The physio, the head physio at the Royal Melbourne Hospital, told me in no uncertain terms, I had obliterated my wrist and I was unlikely to return to full functionality. And it's my right hand. It's like, I realized in that moment just how useless my left hand is for everything. They told me I'd never do normal push-ups again, which for me was a bit of a red rag at a bull. That was kind of the last straw. 40 weeks following the third surgery that I had on that wrist, I hit a personal best on the lift that destroyed me. 5 weeks later, I sent the physio a video of me doing one-arm push-ups on my broken hand. She was right, I wasn't normal. I'm a physio's best friend and worst nightmare. But in a good way. The thing that changed that for me, like when I look back at what my motivation was, it wasn't to prove them wrong. It may have started off that way, but it became more than that. It was this idea that this is happening to me. Why is this happening to me? I've had all these big injuries. Why does this keep happening? And then I considered the words that they'd said. They hadn't given me a chance. That means the next person that has this injury is going to be written off as well. Well, what if I do prove them wrong? What if I manage to recover in a way they haven't seen before? I'm not going to pretend that I'm special, but I know that I can work hard. So I signed up, which kind of taps into purpose, and we'll get there shortly. I knew off the back of the Achilles, off the back of a knee reconstruction, I could problem solve well. I could turn up every day and do the physio exercises, which we all know is a bit touch and go at times. I had evidence to support my recovery, and I had a motivation to do that on behalf of somebody else. So in your experience, Uncle Jude, how have you found purpose on the other side of all of this?
Sure, I was convinced that it was time to say goodbye to St Bernadette's at that stage in North Sunshine. After 7 years, your first parish is always a special kind of time. Where you're learning so much, but you're also finding it very difficult to move on. And after 6 to 10 weeks rest, I returned to the Paulus Seminary in Wantirna, and that's when I applied for a program, as Jared mentioned in the introduction, called CPE, which is Clinical Pastoral Education. It's a great program to discover more about yourself, and you know how I spoke about, I want to know what makes me tick. I want to know how I can be a more effective minister. And also to try to find that link from that first call that I had in responding to the invitation that I felt God was calling me to, of missionary service. So after 10 weeks rest, I returned to the seminary and I applied for this program, and I was accepted at the Austin Hospital in Heidelberg, continuing the path of self-discovery, personal growth, and deepening my spirituality. Now, if Sean and I are sharing the parts of ourselves, I consider you very close friends, even though we don't know each other. For someone to share who they are, when I listen or Sean listens to somebody else and their woundedness, it's a great privilege. It's an honour. So despite the ambiguity of my past, the CBPE program was a turning point in my life. This program helped me in leading me to self-acceptance. By this, I do not imply, you know, that things are as they are and nothing can be changed. For example, if I lived with Sean and he said, "You're a pain in the neck," oh, well, this is who I am, and you're just going to have to live with it. No, it doesn't imply that. But rather to see the need of affirming myself in the context of my past experience. So when this emotion surfaces, I know where it's coming from. Because when I was separated from my mother at birth, okay, for 6 weeks, how could that have an impact on a bub? But then when I had to start school at St. Vincent's in Morwell, I was petrified. I felt that separation happening again. And I don't know of any prep kid that would run out of school and run back home. And Mum would say, "What are you doing here? Sister didn't want me. She kicked me out." And it happened every time something new was about to happen. But when you know, you can do something about it. It no longer takes control. So I believe that the past experience of pain, restlessness, have been moments of grace which struck through a meaningless and empty life. So although the story of my life is one of loss and deprivation, I feel that I do not have to assign blame anymore to myself or to others. What a liberation that is. I have become aware that grace broke into my life was the light that broke into my darkness. Deep within me, I heard a voice telling me, "I am loved and I am capable of loving," and I want to believe that that voice was God. As I continue to embrace that voice within me, I feel I can accept the fact that I am accepted.
And it's such a beautiful reflection, right? The ability to see those moments of grace and gratitude and understanding amidst the rubble that is our lives in those moments. And to be able to cultivate meaning, acceptance, purpose from those events is something that we all have access to. We're all to think about those moments in our own experience. It's obvious that things start to make sense when you spend a bit of time reflecting on them. The line that comes to mind, I think it was Nietzsche and Viktor Frankl to an extent, that the person with a why can overcome almost any how. Right? That's purpose in a nutshell. Like, what is it that we're working towards and why? And in the face of any obstacles, we if that why is great enough, we will find a way to overcome. Without purpose, resilience simply feels like surviving, which it is to some extent. And with my wrist, I realized early on that because I had been written off, it was a matter of moving through that survival period, moving through the pain, moving through the withdrawal symptoms from the pain medication that I'd been on, all of those initial survival steps before coming to the realization that, hey, if I put in the work here, someone else might benefit from this. It was my reflection around how will this develop, help me develop into the person that I'm meant to become. I don't know how long this is going to take. I don't know how hard this is going to be. I don't know where this is going or what the outcome looks like. But if I continue to show up and if I continue to put in the effort and do what I can, then the outcome will look after itself and it will be the best one that's available. For me, purpose was found in the service of others. For Uncle Jude, it rings true as well. It's in alignment with our value system. Taking the time to reflect on that. What is driving me? Where does this come from? working with a client recently, his values, his top two values at his core were connection and adventure. And he was working night shift on his own, never seeing the light of day during winter in Melbourne. No wonder he wasn't feeling great. But he didn't know. It's not until you spend that time working out these questions that you have a greater awareness of yourself. Things become clearer. You have a greater understanding. It's not ignoring the pain that you may be going through at the same time. It's not ignoring the adversity that you're currently working through. Uncle Jude, what role has pain, loss and struggle played in your experience?
Yeah, huge. But as I move into this next phase, I notice there are dads here and there are mums. Please, what I share is my personal experience. So don't think of yourself, I want to reiterate this, oh my God, I bombed out, I should have done this when my kid came up or whatever. Don't even go there. Look at yourself. I'm speaking 40 years ago as I reflected back on my journey. My family, I wouldn't swap them for anyone. And if I had to drag this when I saw it, I wouldn't. And as I said, you pick yourself up. You check out messages that you received, and they might have been all wrong. Okay? So our parents gave us the best, I hope, that they possibly could. Our interpretation of those messages may have gone differently. So when I reflect on my past and the memories of others that I've ministered to, I see how many of our parents, as I look back, had to struggle to secure their material necessities. And so their consciousness is largely defined by their need to assure their physical survival. Thus, Dad working 15 hours a day, I was doing the same thing. See? Mum would often say, why doesn't your father take his bed to Sunday Christ? They spoke only for their actions. You know, I don't think my dad was used to saying, I love you. We're experts at it now. There's never a phone conversation where my siblings don't say, love you. Sean will do it to me now, and I'll do the same for Sean. Love you. But it was after Dad's death that we thought, we can't store that in the memory because it's not there. Okay? So we've learnt a lot. And we do a lot of sharing as a family. When you've got a family of our size, you look forward to those moments. But they were treasured moments. Our parents only spoke through their actions. You know I love you, I don't have to tell you. I'm able to give verbal expression to their love or their disappointments. They had trouble disengaging their individuality from their function as father and mother, and they felt awkward after expressing their inner feelings. This is my reflection that I did 38 years ago. In my case, this seemed to be more dominant in my dad, who expressed very little physical contact with me. And I was craving. I would fight with my younger brother. So on Saturday, Mum would say, take one of them with you, and I'd put my hand up. Just to have that half an hour's trip in the back to be with Dad. Precious. And I also remember actually wanting to please Dad, and I got the lawn mower. I was 13, and I'm mowing the lawn, and Dad was home with a cushion wrapped around his side because he had intense pain with cancer. And I said, I'll surprise him, and I got the mower, and I'm mowing the lawn, and there was a bit of a rattle. A 13-year-old who's not a mechanic doesn't pick that up. But Dad was a motor mechanic, an expert at that too. People queued up in our street on a Saturday afternoon just to make sure that Sam was the man. And he came out and he blasted me. When I was your age, I could strip a car and put it back together again. I was so angry. 15 years after, my mum says, Jude, I don't know if you remember, but you were mowing the lawn and there was a rattle and Dad came out and blasted you. It wasn't him, his normal self. He was in pain and he lost it. I said, yeah. Oh, well, he said sorry. 15 years later, I've been telling you, tell me straight away, the many hours he spent at work, God love him, and his early death in my teenage years had left a sign of pain that followed me into my adult years. His death put an end to any opportunity for me to identify with him, as I said, as the male model. So I was fortunate enough to have older brothers and adult males present and visiting our home. But I have learnt that the pain I felt is shared by many others. Many men live in a more or less hereditary silence, I don't know if it still exists today, that has been passed down from generation to generation. Again, I'm sharing with you an assignment that I did way back when I was doing a little bit of self-work. A silence that denies every teenage boy's need for recognition or confirmation from his father. It is almost as though our fathers were subject to a rule of silence that decrees that fathers who speak are a threat to male solidarity. So in the past, our fathers fled into the taverns of their work. They sought refuge in their cars, their newspapers, TV programs. I don't know, probably we could blame the phone now or social media or whatever, like a drug of addiction. It let them avoid speaking, avoid inhabiting their bodies, avoided entering into relationships.
And it's something that I work with every day. The majority of my client base are men. As a male therapist working with male clients, it's a theme that still rings true, right? Like, as much as we've made a lot of progress, as much as we're starting to empower men and younger boys to speak out, to seek support, to talk to other role models that they might have in their lives, we've still got a ways to go. For me, I had the classic absentee father, the always at work, never emotionally available dad. Quick to anger, which we later found out is likely some kind of neurodivergence that's been undiagnosed and he's been trapped inside his own mind for 77 years. And so it's not until you have more information to work with that you can feel compassion for that. But as a teenage boy who was crying out for attention, crying out for that healthy masculine energy and strength and leadership, it just wasn't there. I remember upon realizing that Dad was either not there or angry, I chose anger because at least that was attention. One night he had me by the scruff of the neck up against the wall and he realised in that moment that this doesn't work anymore. I think he scared both of us. And I ran away because that was all I knew how to do. And it's only upon reflecting on these experiences that you realise that there's something that connects a lot of us. There's a lot of us that have been through our own version of that. And there's a lot of us that aren't talking about it. We don't realise how that transfers into adulthood. We don't realise how that affects our intimate relationships, our friendships, our relationships with our children. And it's not until you start to think, okay, I don't know if this is working anymore. Where can I access the support that at least I might be able to bounce some ideas, get another model to work with? Because in the absence of that, we don't have anything else. We go with what we know. It's not the time to experiment. It doesn't feel safe. But when you're talking to somebody that's been through a similar experience, you realise there's a connection there. It's more common than we're led to believe. We feel empathy. We can be compassionate to the plight of others. It's a shared humanity in those moments. Talking to each other actually brings us closer together if you're prepared to open up a little bit. There's nothing to be scared about. You might be surprised at what happens on the other side. We become more confident in our own story. We become more confident in the power that that has to have a positive impact on the stories of others. And we lead by example. It's from a place of confidence that comes from the strength of having faced adversity, and in spite of what might have seemed insurmountable, in those moments we found a way to prevail. And the scars that we have are proof that we've healed from those experiences. And the idea of the Japanese art form of kintsugi, which some of you might be familiar with, is the Japanese have this way of taking broken pottery and putting it back together, using gold to create something that's more beautiful than what it was originally. And it's just such a beautiful metaphor for all of our life experience, right? We're constantly being broken down and rebuilt. It's not something to be ashamed of, something to be proud of. And when we engage with other people, there's a connection there that gives all of us some energy and some motivation to keep going. So would you tell me some of the lessons, some of the opportunities that presented themselves to you on the other side of these experiences?
Yeah, you know, like, I'm always aware that when I tapped into that brokenness, you know, there was a beautiful book called The Wounded Healer, Henry Nguyen, I think it was. You know, tapping into those wounds, I could go and visit patients without going with my agenda. You know, for example, I remember one verbatim I ran, it was one guy, a Baptist guy, and he said, "I'm afraid of dying." And I said, "Oh, really? What football team do you barrack for?" Why would you even say that exactly? I was avoiding death and talking about death. Now I'm surrounded with it. Okay? But getting in touch with my own pain, my own brokenness, you know, really gave me a new freedom. So Sean, after sinking into depression, I suppose, and realizing that my experiences had completely drained me of energy to deal with the external world, I became less defensive, less sensitive to what others started to think of me. I became more open to risk-taking and self-affirmation. I'm becoming more aware that instead of meeting rejection, when I assume my rightful place, I'm meeting respect. So through the CPE program, where we shared with our peers, had support from supervisors, found strength through prayer and meditation, I had become aware that my moodiness had a history, and I understood my history and could account for it. Getting in touch with my deep, obscure motivations made it possible for me to stop endlessly repeating the same sordid soap opera of my life. Although I was not responsible for my objective faith, I was indeed responsible for making sense of that faith. So the road to responsibility is the road to freedom. And when an individual stops telling himself or herself it's somebody else's fault, a new world opens up for them. Understanding and accepting themselves will prepare them to accept the consequences of their actions. They'll no longer need to beg for understanding from others or to humble themselves in order to obtain it.
And it's this idea of radical acceptance. Radical responsibility is another way it's thrown out there, that I am the sum of the consequences of all of the decisions that have gotten me to this point. And there's something empowering about that. It's not blame. It's an opportunity to take the lessons learned there and be responsible for what happens next. It's in the resistance to reality that things become pretty negative. I don't want this to happen. This shouldn't be happening. Though that kind of language, it's not helpful. It might feel good in the moment. You might rally the troops and get everyone feeling sorry for you. It doesn't help. Because at some point, in order to move through it, you're like, okay, this is the hand I've been dealt. What's the best way to play that? And it's knowing that that's not final. You can play your hand more than once. We get stuck on making the right decision. It's not about making the right decision, it's making the decision right. Just pull the trigger and allow everything else to fall into place. Because it's not until we stop blaming something external to ourselves that the real value available in our experience becomes clear. When I discovered that the common denominator in all of the hardship that I'd experienced was me, it was a bit humbling to say the least. But it did open my eyes up to opportunities that were ahead of me. There's this idea that depression stems from an inability to control the past, and anxiety stems from an inability or a desire to control the future, which robs us of the present moment, which is where the value is. A lot of what we're feeling in any given moment, if there's a negative attachment to it, is from not feeling safe. And it's like, why don't I feel safe right now? It's usually not a consequence of what's happening in that moment. It's usually off the back of an experience we've had in the past that feels the same way. And the more we're in tune with those experiences, the more we can detach from them with what's going on right now. It helps us move from why is this happening to me to something more empowering, which is, what's the lesson in this experience for me? And that's where a shift starts to happen. I'm not pretending to discount the significance of some of the life challenges that get thrown at people. That's not what this is about. You know, some people have been through horrific experiences and trauma. In those moments, it's reaching out for support that is the best thing that anyone can do. Because to know that you're not alone in those experiences is probably the most important thing to know. Because there's always support available. I cannot stress that enough. People are like, oh, I haven't got any family around. There is someone. You can pick up the phone. You can call a helpline. You can reach out to a friend. You can send someone a text message. There is an option. Uncle Jude, where have you sourced inspiration from to get you out of those times of need?
Thanks, Sean. I'm conscious of time. We're winding this up now. This is something that Sean and I found difficult to keep it within an hour. So if you can hang in there for the next 10 minutes, and then we'll give you some questions. It's heavy stuff, but it's liberating stuff. Otherwise, we can just preach at you. And there's nothing greater than hearing somebody else's testimony or story and identifying with some things so that you can see it's okay, it's normal. You know, you're not crazy. Okay. So faith, again, Sean, was the glue that brought it all together as I looked at how Jesus had handled stress. As I turned to Scripture and contemplated on the life of Jesus as my model during tough times, following his example of resilience, which we'll take a look at shortly, and following his example of stress management. It's in the letter to the Hebrews, a bit small, but I'll try to go through that for you. Therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, as Sean said, we're not alone. Let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely. And let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us. Looking to Jesus, the Hebrew authors tells us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith, who for the sake of the joy of that was set before him, he went full on, straight to the cross, disregarding its shame, and has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such hostility against himself from sinners, so that you may not grow weary or lose heart. You know, guys, nobody experienced greater stress than Jesus Christ. He experienced enormous pressure, He was criticized constantly. He was misunderstood. There were constant demands on his life. He had little privacy. And there were people who were trying constantly to kill him. Yet when we look at the life of Jesus Christ, we see that in his ministry, he walked and lived with an amazing peacefulness. No matter however difficult the situation, he modeled a calmness and a resilience in the face of outrageous demands that were put on him. And this is why the letter to the Hebrews advises us to keep our eyes on Jesus.
And it's the beauty of some perspective as well, right? There's always something to be grateful for. It doesn't have to be big. Be grateful that you've shown up this evening and shared a meal with some like-minded people. You've had a conversation that made you feel a bit better about yourself. You had a really good coffee this morning. Like, gratitude doesn't have to be this big thing. Gratitude gets a big rap in, you know, pop culture these days, but for good reason. The idea of reflecting on what have I got to be thankful for is a really powerful exercise when it's done repeatedly. It changes the way we perceive things. The idea of doing more things that I enjoy doing and my life will improve. Spending time with the people that you enjoy spending time with. Partaking in activities that you find enjoyable. It's kind of basic stuff. If you do it enough, things get better. For the bigger obstacles we face, that's where support comes in. It's the humility to ask somebody else, what do you think I should do here? Hey, I'm struggling right now. Have you got space for me to talk? In the therapeutic space, we talk about the analogy of climbing a mountain. My client expects me to have all of the answers. I don't. It's just unrealistic at the best of times. But I'm climbing a mountain over here, you're climbing a mountain over there. I can see what's ahead of you on your mountain. So I can give you some tips. I can say, hey, just keep an eye out for that thing. Hey, have you done some training before you go there? It's the same in life. Some of us have a little bit more experience in domains that others don't. It's just a word of warning. Hey, just keep an eye out. We've all got wisdom that we carry with us. And it's taking opportunities to connect with people and share that wisdom that become part of the purpose that brings us all together. And we are shy on time, so we will touch on Jesus' six steps to building resilience and finding purpose. And there's more content behind this if anyone's interested, so just let us know and we'll send you some more information if you like. Albert Jude, would you like to wrap us up?
Sure. Fulton, how you going? Hanging in there? Good man.
Yes.
So we're going to go through these six steps or secrets of Jesus. So when you're under stress, number one, remember how much God loves you. Okay. This is the first antidote for stress. It's the principle of compassion. Jesus had no doubt in his mind that God the Father loved him. It was very clear to him. John 10:17. The Father loves me. It is important to own and to remember that God loves you unconditionally, that God loves you even extravagantly. God loves you continuously. He will never stop loving you. This was the foundation of Jesus. This is the first secret of the resilient life. If you're not convinced that God always loves you, you're going to be easy prey, dear friends, for the approval of other people. You will be going on as a people. The second key that we see in the life of Jesus is this. Remember who you are. Remember who I am. This is the principle of identification. Now, why is it important? Because if you're not sure who you really are, you're going to be whipped around, dear friends, manipulated and molded by the pressures and the problems and the people around you. You have a confused identity. Now, what was the first thing the demon asked Jesus before he started ministry? If you are. The three temptations were, if you are, do this, if you are the Son of God. You know, put doubt in Jesus' mind, then the demon's got control. So you have to have a clear identity, and when you do not know who you are, it makes you more prone to stress. Why? Because our culture will try and fit you into its mold. It's going to make you into what it wants you to be. The third step, as we look at Jesus as our model, is to know who I'm trying to please. In other words, know who you are living for. This is the principle of motivation. You need to know what is your deepest motivation. If you do not know that, you're prone to stress. What motivates you, I ask every day? Even God can't please everybody. I know as a priest, I'm always going to be disappointing somebody. Why? Because everyone has different expectations. That is why Jesus said in John chapter 5:30, I'm not trying to do what I want, but only what my Father who sent me wants. The fourth principle of resilience that we learn from looking at Jesus as our model, focus on what matters most. This is the principle of concentration. What I mean by this is when you know where you are headed and you focus, you're not distracted by less important things. It's a matter of priorities. Jesus was a master at focusing on his life and his mission, a master of concentration. As the time drew near for him to return to heaven, he moved steadily onward to Jerusalem with an iron will. He had a goal. He knew where he was going to die in Jerusalem. He was determined and he was focused. And if you want your life to have impact, choose something important to focus on. The fifth step of resilience that we learn from it, looking at Jesus as a model, this is the big one. Spend time alone with God. Something I had to find. This secret of resilience and stress resistance may be the one you do the least, especially in our fast-moving world. Spending enough time with God, and yet it is absolutely essential to building a resilient spirit and managing chronic stress. It is the principle of meditation. Prayer is a great stress reliever. It is a decompression chamber. It is a way to unload your burdens. In Luke 22, it was Jesus' habit to go to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. A habit is something that you do through repetition. Again, we see how Jesus made a habit of prayer in Mark's Gospel. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. We need quiet times to renew, to reflect, and to recharge. I think it was Pascal who said, the philosopher, most of our problems come as a result of our inability to sit still in a room alone. Set your morning with God. And the final step in building resilience, dear friends, the first thing that Jesus did, get a small group of support. Sean's mentioned a number of them there. First thing Jesus did in starting his ministry, he started a small group. 12 apostles. Dear friends, you were never intended to handle stress by yourself. So much of us, of our stress, is self-imposed. We think it depends all on me. One thing I've learned, it doesn't. God has not willed you to be the general manager or the manager. You don't have to have all the answers. And you can say, I don't know. I'll check. I'll look it up for you. Give me a bit of time. Even Jesus needed a small group for support. When he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he said to one of his small group members, "Stay here and keep watch with me." Even Jesus needed the support of a small group when he was in crisis. There are people in our faith community or a church family who are waiting to support you, to assist you, if you are only humble enough to ask, to share your gifts and to serve in your community. Give so much life in so many ways. So here is a secret. Get involved. Join a small group. Stress is increasing in our culture. Loneliness has become an epidemic. So we need to reach out to our church groups. Seek out support from professionals, people like Sean, and other support groups. You know, there's that beautiful song that the Beatles formed, "Hey Jude." When I broke down, there was a line in that that I felt he was speaking to me. "Matt, don't carry the world on your shoulder." Do you want me to sing it for you? Guys, there's only one person who has carried the weight of this world on his shoulders, and that is Jesus. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Just to stand up, just move your legs a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
It's no good falling asleep.
Arms locked up.
Take a moment, and then if anyone's got any questions, feel free to fire away.
Thank you, Father Jude and Sean, for that. Thank you, Benoit. Just before we go to questions, Garden Beer is a free event, but we also ask if you'd like to donate, that'd be great. So we've got a couple of brothers from the Knights who will just wander around if you want to donate to. Provide more nights like this, that'd be wonderful. Well, like so much came from that, I wrote a lot, but just something that popped out, vulnerability. I heard a Road to Emmaus moment at the start, you know, finding purpose of meaning and resilience. That being in trying to be in control the whole time, but then learning to lean on God. And then Peter might pick up on this. You mentioned, Father, you're sharing. I'm sharing with you, and now we're great friends. John Hendry, our second guest speaker, said something very similar. I'm now sharing my story with you, so now we're friends. And then also, just about you finished with faith, that was the glue that brought it together, and then our Lord's six steps. If anyone's got any questions, I might run around with the microphone and
we put a time out. What's the time?
Yeah, it's 10 to 9. We've got 15 minutes.
15 minutes, good for you guys. You've been great. It's been a long day from work. And it'd be sort of. Ainley, you've done well.
Has anyone got a question?
I have a question for you. What makes an 18 year old side wanting to be a priest? Because you live your life as a priest, and you've seen all the negatives in the confessional of a married couple, and I'm sure you've seen samples of it. But you say, what if? I'm sure at 18 you must have had a childhood sweetheart, so do you ever say, what if?
Yeah, good question. Thanks for that, John. Yes, I did have a girlfriend, but I was... It wasn't very long. It was probably about 6 months, and then I dropped her. But probably it was that crisis moment, John. There's so much you miss out. But I think when my dad died, I started to ask questions. Why are we born? Why does a man die 49 years of age and leave all these kids? When I started to ask, the deeper questions of life. I think that's when it started. So that's when I heard the call. And then I started to respond to invitations, like a come and see weekend with the Paulus Fathers, another come and see with the Maris Brothers. So something was starting to stir. So probably yeah. it would have been
that. My question, because I never married, you know,
yeah.
and I never really had a golden opportunity, but had some minor opportunities. But I've always wanted to know, there's much more to life than just having, making babies and going to work. I need to know more. I need to know more. And that's a good reason why I stay single. And you answer your question the same way. You want to know more of life, and becoming a priest is what you felt is going to get you there.
Thanks, John. Any other questions, guys? Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask Sean particularly. My son really does need someone to talk to, and he realizes he's got a problem. He's very lonely, right? But it's getting him to make that decision to get somebody to help him.
Yep.
He doesn't sort of believe in psychiatrists. It's got a very
yep.
negative appeal to that, but
yep.
it bothers me greatly because I can't help him.
Yep.
When his dad was alive, he used to go to his dad, but it's not the same. I feel that when we're children, we need our mothers, maybe from birth to maybe 12. And then I only have boys, so I don't know about girls. But I feel that boys need the men in their lives from maybe 12 upwards. That's the dad's role after the mother's role is earlier in life, I think. And I think if you're lucky enough to have a good dad that will listen to him and give him good advice, and what you were saying before, and Brother Jude about his dad, that really makes sense to me, because he really still, after 8 years on somebody with his dad's past, and he still feels it very, very intensely, more than his other brothers,
yeah.
that he's the youngest one.
Yeah.
And I just won't help him.
Yeah, yeah. It's a common thing for a lot of guys. It's the first part is dealing with the misconceptions that reaching out to help actually looks like. It's a big reason why I chose counselling over, you know, a psychology kind of option, because the counselling is more conversational. It's just, I enjoy the fact that I can sit in a room opposite someone and we just have a chat. And I think for a lot of guys, I don't realise that that's what it's about when they reach out for support. You know, no one's there to judge you, diagnose you, try to fix your problems. It's like, I'd just like to know a bit about you, like what's going on. It's kind of those questions, and it's realizing that it's quite an informal thing. It's just talking to another guy. The beauty of it is, they don't know anything about you. Like, there's a detachment there. They're not going to get emotionally involved. They're not going to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. Like, on my website, I've done quite a lot of writing around dispelling the myths around therapy, particularly targeted at men, because we have all these misconceptions around what it looks like to ask for support. And the messaging that is fairly common to me is that most of the guys I see wish they'd done it earlier.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, this is amazing. Like, a guy I worked with recently, he walked out and he goes, I feel lighter. I'm like, that's what we're looking for. Like, that's perfect feedback as far as I'm concerned.
And I relate to you with all your injuries, because he's had a lot of injuries at the moment, and he hasn't been able to work because he can't walk properly with his... He's got to have an operation.
Oh, right, okay.
And so that sort of really, you know, you've got something in common. So.
Yeah, I mean, you can give me my contact details and I'll just have a chat over the phone if you want. It's just like...
It's just getting him to do it.
And that's the thing too, like I'm not, like I think my approach is trying to make this as accessible as possible, like the messaging, I put something out on social media because it's kind of, some of the messaging on social media is driving me insane. I'm not going to sell therapy, like it just feels out of integrity with the whole thing. If you're feeling like things could be better, you're probably right. Just reach out to somebody that can have that conversation with you.
That's what he was saying.
Yeah, exactly. And for a lot of guys, I did some high school mentoring for a while with a local high school, and yeah, like when we're in single parent families, it's really hard to get the right balance of support there. It's just a consequence of the dynamic. And yeah, but there's support available. If like I'm happy to just have a chat and see what's going on for him.
Okay.
Ivy spells it right. Yeah, but it's just like, it's, you'll realize, like, most guys realize that it's, when they pull the trigger on it, it's not as big a deal as what they've made it up to be in their head. There's the Stoic quote that is, we suffer more in imagination than we do in reality. I feel like that's applicable there. Like, we tend to imagine that reaching out for support is this big thing, and then you walk into a room and there's someone like, hey, how's it going?
Yeah.
It's just another person.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's really quite an enjoyable experience for most. So, yes.
I'll look up you.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll be happy to help. Yeah.
How's it going?
Anyone else like to throw something out there?
I have one question. So we all have trials and challenges in life. So my question is, should we live in the here and now, or should we question or surrender to God? That's really important. Should we surrender to God, or should we live in the here and now? And so I keep struggling sometimes. I do have faith in God. When I have my challenges, I used to refer to them as problems, but I've shifted that, and I've changed that word, problems, to challenges.
Gone blank with names.
Michelle.
Michelle, it's a very important question, and Sean might share a little bit, but yeah, it's a challenge. Because a challenge is more positive, isn't it? It's something that I can grow out of this. So it's a good step forward, Michelle, and we're called to live in the present. Because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We're not too sure about all the stuff that I went through in the back, in the past with Sean, but we use the past to help us to be more grounded today. But I think those six steps of Jesus really help us. So use those as tools. I'm happy to put them together and hand them over to the Knights, and somehow we'll just leave your name if you wanted any of those notes tonight. We'll get them over to you. So just leave them with the Knights. But yeah, but when you're living, you're called to live out of the life of God. You know, and that's what we're all trying and yearning for. You know, otherwise we're walking zombies, aren't we? The beauty of the Christian faith is, you know, we've got that lovely Good Friday, Easter Sunday, dying and rising. You know, there can be no Easter Sunday, as we've heard so many times, without Good Friday. Peter didn't want to hear it. In today's gospel reading, Peter goes, what are you talking about, Jesus? You can't get to Jerusalem, they're going to kill you. Get behind me, Satan, you're a stumbling block. No, so there are Good Fridays, but there's redemptive moments in the Christian life. Sure, I don't know.
I think, yeah, the power of language is really important there too. Like when we reframe from it being a problem to being a challenge that I just need to get through, it's like the analogy of you driving along and there's a speed bump. Like you slow down as you approach the speed bump and you speed up after you get over it. Like they're just a series of those. Sometimes they're a bit bigger, sometimes they're a bit closer together, but you keep moving forward. So it's the perception that we're kind of stuck, because it doesn't feel like we're making any progress, that can kind of, or it feels like we're going through the same stuff. It's that's actually not the reality at play. It's like by getting another day under our belt, we've got more experience to work with. We're getting more momentum just through the domain of time. Like, yeah, I've got one more day of experience that I can work with. What did I learn today? What have I got? Again, it's wrestling with it. And it's admitting that it's hard. Sometimes it's just really hard. Sometimes, like, pretending it's not is harder than just admitting that it is. And if we go, yeah, you know what, this is really shitty right now. And it's been really shitty for a long time. But it's probably not going to stay there forever. That can just help alleviate some of the pressure that is in the resistance to it feeling just the way that it is. I think using your past experience as evidence that you can keep going, keep moving forward, and bringing it back to what you've got access to in the moment, that's something.
Does that help?
It does. My experiences have taught me to change my pain into power.
Yeah.
Dead power.
And I'll continue to do that.
Thank you. So it's surrendering to the here and now.
Yeah.
To the things I cannot change. Be right to say that?
Yeah, it's the serenity prayer comes to mind. You know, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. We might wind down.
I something that a lot of the fears don't come true. So you constantly can't go on fear. A lot of them don't come true. They're in your head. So if you're going to focus on something, focus on the positive, and maybe some will come true.
One more addition to that, because I love that. We often overestimate the magnitude of the challenge and we underestimate our ability to overcome it.
Thanks, John. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to finish off, but before I do, I want to thank you. You know, it's obviously you're out here tonight in such a great number because it's a topic that relates to your own journey in life. And I hope that this is a healing time, because we are worth being seen and see ourselves as God's greatest gift. You know, we invest so much money in making sure we service the car and all these material things, but we are creating the image and likeness of God. So it's important to know that and to lead with that. I want to thank my nephew, Sean, whom I love dearly, and I'm not just throwing that in, Sean, because I mentioned it before that we never used to say it when we were younger. But it's great catching up with Sean and to see that he's moved into a place where he's servicing people and touching and healing lives. But really, as Sean would agree, Sean would just be as John and myself are called to be. We help people through the questions we ask to hear, to get the answers. Because I can't fix anybody. You're healing yourself, of course, through God's grace. But it's getting the right questions so that you can get the answers and the insights. And I want to thank our Knights of the Southern Cross for the great work they do. I know John is better at it than I am, but your meetings, I haven't been to many, but I know that you're doing great work. I'm in the loop with regards to the minutes that come through. And thank you once again. If we could give a round of applause to our Knights.
Thank you, Jude and Sean.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you all for coming. It's lovely to see some new faces here tonight that weren't here last time. So here's our members. And just for a thank you, we've got a gift. So Mario, our Curra Branch Chairman, has everything to give.
That is really dry, and you know, Sean and Father Jude have turned it around into something very inspiring based on their own experience, which I really respect. And yeah, look, and thank you all for coming. I'm really grateful because this turnout has been the best we've ever had. So I'm really grateful. Thank you.
I'd just like to add one thing. Father Jude was asked way back in November, I think. You know how busy he is. So it was a bit of a challenge. But he said yes straight away. He had a different topic put to him, but he changed it to this one and then roped his nephew in with him. And I'm also a counsellor. So I reckon this was absolutely fantastic tonight. A really great presentation. Thank you very much.
Benoit, Patrick and Gilbert are also our members in the Knights. And we have a rotation of what we do every year. So be new face next year. So.